Ça, c'est la caisse. Le mouton qui te voit, qui te veut, est dedans. So he's basically he's drawn a box with three holes, and the sheep is in there. Is it inside? Because he doesn't see the sheep, but he knows, with his childlike exuberance, that the sheep is inside the box.
Because the imagination of the ideal sheep cannot be captured by this.
He's in the box.
He's in the box. You do it. Hello and welcome to Neo Bohemia. I'm your host, Charlie Layton. This episode is dedicated to the theme of je ne sais quoi. That's the French translation of I don't know what, literally. And it's the phrase to define the indescribable, or X factor. And when we apply it to artists or art, it's that moment where you see a performer or a performance or a piece of work and words fail you or thoughts fail you even. And there's somebody who I wanted to talk to about because I think he is just like that. I think of personality tests, and I've seen one question in a personality test that says, what would you rather be, charming or mysterious? And this person to me is the extreme of both, actually. So please welcome Ben Cerf. Ben Cerf, thank you for coming on.
Hi. Wow, I'm honored. Honored, really. Thank you.
Ben Cerf, you are a performer in New York City, and in my opinion, I think you are one of the most bohemian New Yorkers as far as what the life of bohemia could be, of the not necessarily the starving artist, but person who lives off their art, who struggles every day to make more and to be creative in ways that that we don't usually see in our modern day.
I like that, thank you.
And the other thing is, I think of you, and I don't know exactly what you do. I've worked on a few things with you. You front the band Skull Buggery, of which I play accordion.
Amazing accordion, yes.
Sometimes mandolin.
Yes.
And mandolin. I'm looking to get a hurdy-gurdy ready.
I can't wait till you do that.
He's Captain Mackerel of Skull Buggery.
Captain Mackerel Jackson.
Captain Mackerel Jackson. it's a pirate band that has sailed on a Clipper ship.
Clipper City, yes, the Clipper City, 150-foot schooner.
You're an actor?
Yes, I've worked with the Living Theater, Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping, the House of Yes, I continue to perform there currently.
Yeah, you played Salvador Dali once?
Yeah, that was a good one. That was a really good one. And
most recently, Rudolph, the Red-Nosed Reindeer, transformed to a more corporate...
He was quite evil. I always end up playing the nefarious character, though, the anti-hero. And also, Captain Hook. I had the pleasure of performing an aerial version of Captain Hook.
Fantastic.
Yes.
Can you say evil one more time?
Evil.
Can you say je ne sais quoi?
Je ne sais quoi.
And you just got back from a trip in Europe. Where were you?
Well, I was in Freiburg, Germany. Doing an art installation for an EDM festival, which was quite fun, yeah.
So you're a balloon artist as well?
This piece was balloons, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I do other pieces too. I do a lot of, I do metal work as well.
Metal work?
Yeah, I weld. I can lift things and hammer and screw and all that, yeah. Not usually my pieces though. I don't really build in metal. I assist. Mm-hmm.
And I've seen your work in cardboard as well because you have these outer shells for these bicycles that resemble pirate ships for Skull Buggery, and also the time you basically kidnapped a bride at a wedding.
Oh yeah, you saw that video. That's yes. Funny. Yes, that was a fun experience. Yeah, but the bicycle ships are it's got a statement as well. We're basically patrolling the bicycle lanes.
Oh.
And yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
So you cover a strange, weird breadth of what is performance and what is art.
I hope it's all art, I think. But I'm pretty sure that I'm 100% in the art category. Yeah. No, that's an interesting thing that you bring to me. Because there is a... I don't use that term, really.
Je ne sais quoi.
Je ne sais quoi. Yeah. Often. It's... it's an old phrase.
Yeah.
But there is that mysterious thing that you see in certain people, and I'm amazed that you would apply it to me. I'm impressed, I guess. But I've seen, you know, I saw Al Sharpton come to Occupy,
mm-hmm.
and this guy at Union Square just appeared with his two bodyguards, but he was glowing like no other person. Mm-hmm. As he just walked there to go and enjoy the protests, and
he had a je ne sais quoi about him.
Dude, the guy glowed in the dark.
He has like an aura.
As bright as the sun, as he just walked past me. Yeah, and that's probably what you mean. This thing.
Yeah.
I'm very shocked that you would think that I have this, but I'm. It's something I would strive for sure. I do strive for.
Well, yes, I just like the idea that a person or a person's art can escape the describable. And to me, very often, you are indescribable.
Yes?
If someone said, well, what do you know about Ben Cerf? I could rattle what I just uncover half of the experience, too.
Yeah. I'm struggling with that myself. No, that is a huge problem for me, actually. Because I do a lot that I don't even remember. I don't document half the things that I do. And I just had this conversation today.
Do you just get involved in certain art happenings, performances, art pieces?
Well, you know, at the end of a show, when you're doing like a theater piece, let's just say, because you do theater mm-hmm. as well, that when you are done with the show, it's the final show, you've built a family, right? You've got 3 months, if you're lucky, you've got 3 months of rehearsals, and then you've got your show, which is a full-on intense round of shows, and then, boom, it's done. Yeah. And this is the point where you can succumb to exhaustion, but if you're not ready for that, and you don't want to get sick, you strategically place the next project.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you are notoriously skilled at what the next project is.
I am. I mean, I do have bouts of sequestering myself in my room,
mm-hmm.
my studio here, and watching films.
Mm-hmm.
But I run to the next project, to the detriment of not recording what I just did, or even appreciating, really. The scenarios that
but so often with you, Ben, the next project is different than the last project.
Yeah, it can be wildly different. Yeah,
which is why you cover an interesting variety of things.
Yes.
So
yes.
What are the more interesting things you've done that you barely remember?
Well, you like the Dali piece?
Yeah.
That came about as a phone call from one of my dear friends at the House of Yes, Anya, who constructed that place. She called me from she was on tour herself in Austin, called me with an idea. They had a prop piece, an egg, mm-hmm. a giant egg that descends from the ceiling. And she said, she called me up for my mustache. That resembles
for those of you listening, Ben Cerf has a very interesting mustache that can easily, with a little bit of pomade or wax,
oil of Olay, yeah,
helps it stick out exactly like the artist Salvador Dali.
It does its thing. I'm trying not to be too metrosexual with it. I don't groom it too much, mm-hmm. and I also need my own identity. But you know, it does curl up in a friendly manner. it makes me happy when I do catch myself in the mirror occasionally.
Very nice.
The Dali piece, yeah, she called me up and I said, holy shit, I was just listening to a piece on the radio. There was a bolero thing, Ravel,
mm-hmm.
that it immediately all came to me. I had just seen an interview with Dali the week before, like 1950s black and white thing. An hour long of ludicrous, surrealist speech or interview. Wasn't really an interview. The guy was just railing crazy. Because that's his MO. But what I did, I married these two artists, Ravel and Dali. Ravel as the soundtrack behind it. And then Dali, I cut up this hour-long interview. I think it was Walter Matthau or something.
Wow.
I cut it up using an editing program, and I got the best pieces from this interview of things I wanted to know about Dali myself, and that I thought others might be interested to know. And also, I had to make it more and more crazy, so I had to tailor his descent into surrealistic ranting. And also, I had to capture his phenomenal accent, which is, you know, he speaks English, Spanish, Italian, French, Catalan, you know, so he's easily, like, flowing from language to language. Mm-hmm. You'll get a lot of le and Spanish as well, and every, you know what, I got a criticism every time from a new audience member about the, no matter how many times I listened to this piece that I had constructed to capture his accent. There was always a criticism. Oh, that's too French. Oh, that's... He wasn't that Spanish. He wasn't that Italian. Whatever.
And what about the egg?
Oh, the... Well, the piece is incredible. Anya descends from the egg as an aerialist. She's up in the egg. Nobody knows. But as I'm ranting, this egg slowly descends from the ceiling. It cracks open the white silks that she's about to...
Rappel down
and do her dance. Descends, I eat it, and these two clocks come to life with people inside and do a dance. They're surrealist, bendy clocks draped about. They appear, I kill them. She descends, she becomes Gala, the muse, his wife. And she descends, does this amazing piece in a onesie that she's painted. You know, because we are living in a new, in a shaven. The ladies are shaven these days. She had to paint on the onesie her the nipples and the bush,
I see.
If you will.
Well, that also makes it more painterly, I guess, more abstract.
Oh yes. Yeah. And I do. Yes, I forgot. Also, I have a 3-foot paintbrush. Yeah, and a palette. Yes, she comes, she seduces me, I'm intrigued, and then we do a little dance, she circles me into the egg, and it captures me and drags me up to my demise.
Fantastic.
That's that piece. I can expound on the other ones too, depending on the question that comes.
So, where are you from originally?
Mm. I am an anchor baby.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My parents both came from France, from Paris and Bordeaux, my mother from Bordeaux. They moved, they followed a friend of theirs to San Francisco and started a life there. They had me born, conceived in the Congo.
Oh,
they
wow.
were working on a film. So yes, I am an anchor baby when it was legal to do that, still in the 70s.
So what was the first inspiration, what first struck you into a life in the arts?
Ooh. You know, I remember distinctly the first time that I realized the power of performance. And it scared me the first time. Yeah. It messed me up for a good.
As audience or performer?
As a performer, yeah. The power that I held at that moment when I was 8 years old. Now, the quick backstory is that we had me born here in the States, but we left immediately after. And so my first language was French. We went back to Paris and lived there until I was 7. But what they weren't able to do was tell me, like, you're going to a new city, and they speak a totally different language. So I arrived here in this great country, and I didn't know that they were speaking a different language. I just thought everyone was stupid. I really thought they were, who are these Cro-Mags that can't... articulate, they can't talk. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that I was the one who didn't speak their language. It quickly became apparent. See, I was cocky at first. Then I realized I was, and so I chilled out. I took a step back, learned the language, English.
Mm.
And then I found myself at this retreat. Like 100 kids from the school And somebody had the brilliant idea to have me read some intro to our great council of the evening. I don't know what it was. I read it through once and instantly dismissed it as boring and stupid. So I don't know, with my humor, I kind of spiced it up a little bit. And the crowd reacted well, favorably, but so strongly. I mean, I remember holding the microphone and reading from this yellow piece of paper. And the power in my hand was immediately apparent, and it scared the shit out of me. And I, after the first paragraph, ran, because I could not tell, were they laughing with me, laughing against me? They were definitely laughing with me, and I had them in my hand, and I could not handle the strength of this moment.
When you have a group of people's attention and they're wrapped in what you're saying.
100 brutal fucking kids. Can I swear on this thing?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. it's not NPR, is it? I ran straight through the hall, middle aisle, 100 kids, either, you know, 50 on either, and I bawled into the arms of our camp counselor, and, dude, I was heaving. If I could have died there, I would have.
So a sense of the power, the effect that you were having by hearing your own voice amplified, reading.
Yeah, it wasn't nothing to do with my voice amplified. It was the strength of the audience.
Oh.
The clapping, the laughter, or the you know.
So what you were getting back in real time.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, the feedback was too much for me to handle. It was definitely the feedback of the audience. Yeah. Definitely there is a power in performance, and it intrigues me, and I was too young to understand.
Nice. What was the first performance or art piece that you did in New York?
In New York, when I arrived in New York, what was I doing? I was spending a lot of time in the Lower East Side doing, I would visit the Collective Unconscious that was on Ludlow Street. It's her birthday today, actually.
Reverend Jen?
Yeah.
Happy birthday, Jen.
Yeah, I just came from there. I just came from her birthday party. We were in a swimming pool in a bar in the East Village on 10th and Avenue B. I was in my underwear, bathing in a kiddie pool, and drinking champagne. The performances, yes, I probably spoke something weird there. I really enjoyed that, the freedom of performance there.
Collective Unconscious at Ludlow was amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, it was really nerdy, like I could appreciate. You could do anything. Like, anybody could go up there, toothless, drunk, or skilled and trying something new, and nobody was judging, and that was the beauty of that moment.
Anti-slam, everyone gets 10.
yes.
Everyone gets a 10.
Everyone gets 10. And then I'd go to Baby Jupiter. That was free. Baby Jupiter around the corner. You had these moldy couches, and a shitty stage, but good equipment, fairly good, you know.
So you did the open mics.
Yeah. Well, no. I was a little more perfectionist, so I rehearse a lot and I play with bands, and I like to have my pieces well rehearsed. So I did play that stage, yeah, Baby Jupiter and Arlene's Grocery when it was still free. Jupiter died, is it gone? Collective Unconscious is gone. Arlene's, once they started charging, even $3 was too much. Mm. Not because of the money, but because of the sudden, when you pay money, you expect a certain level of professionalism, and it was not about that for me. So that era was quickly ruined by 2000, I think.
So tell me about Reverend Billy and the Church of Stop Shopping.
Wow.
Were you there from the beginning, or did you jump in?
No. He opened that up in 99. I joined probably 2004. I knew about him already. And it kind of freaked me out, actually, because I'm hugely allergic to any kind of religious fanaticism. But when I was brought in, and they will tell you that their interview of me was actually, they felt like it was my interview of them, because I'm hugely sick. I was just waiting for them to mention God, mm-hmm. and I would have been out the door. We called it a sexy mystery thing. You know, whatever you believe in, it's non-denominational church. It's basically a reverend and a 40-person choir, smaller on certain occasions, but taking back the community sense, the love, you know, and not to get too hippie on that, but the community, the sense of community, the anti-corporation, the local businesses, to bring this kind of thing back into focus, but to throw it at the corporations, the evangelicals, using their terminology, speaking to them, using their words, but really, like, if you're supposed to be Christian, you're supposed to love your neighbor, you're supposed to love the poor, you know, it's not a capitalist.
And so thing. Often, evangelicals and corporations...
It's about the money.
Yeah.
It's about the money, which is as un-Christian as you can get. Jesus threw out, he threw them out of the temple.
Yeah.
The money lenders, the banks... He threw them out.
Camel through the eye of a needle.
And so, with this Reverend Billy, we've done, street theater, but basically we go to every protest. We challenge the people to think for themselves, because we're not telling them that we know. We don't know what I didn't speak to God last night, and he didn't tell me what you should be doing. No. We go out and do our shenanigans. Asking you to look at why. Wait, why are these people doing this on the street? Why are they acting in this manner? Why are, like, for instance, if I'm doing a scenario we'll do a thing called a shoplift. It's called a shoplift. What we're doing is not stealing. We are entering one by one into a Victoria's Secret. And we won this campaign, by the way. We won flying colors. Oh, my God. We would go into Victoria's Secret, one by one, file in as shoppers, and start fondling the lingerie. You pick them up, and you describe its path to your hand. You describe, okay, well, this was farmed from, silkworms or cotton field, plucked by migrant workers.
Right.
No matter what country you're in, the workers on the field are migrants. They're rarely locals. Underpaid as well. Then we're talking about the crafting in the shops. Now, to get that intricate weave on your delicate intimacies, you need five-year-old fingers, really. It's children who are making your product in Vietnam. Underpaid again. Then we're talking about the no, I'm saying this
about sweatshop labor.
Yeah. Then we're bringing in the fossil fuels to get this piece of, and I'm talking to this piece of underwear, this rose colored underwear, and I'm saying it louder and louder and louder, like my voice is rising in a slow crescendo, we're raising it up into the sky. Slowly, slowly. And all 20 of us are doing this at the same time. This is causing a ruckus. Now the shopkeepers, they're also quite young, 17, maybe 20. They're starting to freak out. The security guards are starting to freak out. And we are raising up to, we're yelling about how this piece was brought from a ship, a container ship from China, to a train, to a bus, to get to this shopping mall.
Right.
And then they kick us out, and people look around and they're like, what the fuck was that? What the hell was that? Oh, I heard something about sweatshop labor. I heard something about five-year-old children making my clothing. I feel a little bit gross about this.
Right.
I feel uncomfortable. And that's what it is. I'm not telling you that Jesus didn't say that you should buy sweatshop labor products. I'm not telling you that. I'm telling you, just think for yourself. Like, clearly that's wrong. You wouldn't have your child working in a factory. No.
So that's activist happening theater, right?
Oh, yeah. This is the street theater stuff. We've learned a lot from the Living Theater. We are affecting the people. And, like, the marching in the street happened in the 60s. It happened before. I mean, there were revolutions before. We're trying not to kill people these days. So in the 60s, there was, yeah, people parading around with, you know, with signs. You do that now, and it's so easy in our, you know, steel boxes, cars, to be pissed off. Like, there they go again, those activists. There they are, just protesting bullshit again. Who cares? They're in my way. They're blocking the bridge. I need to get to work. I got shit to do. I gotta go to work tomorrow. I gotta feed the kids, blah, blah, blah. When you're protesting with signs, you're not affecting people anymore. We're not affecting people. All this marching in the street is not cool. People are not receptive to it.
It's so easy to zone it out.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And that's why you have to figure a new artistic pathway to it?
Yes, and we have these. It's so easy. Like, as I told you before, with these cardboard ships that I build, we're protecting the bike lanes. So what are we doing? We're dressing up as pirates. We've got these cardboard bases around our bicycles, and we're attacking them. We have another group that does the clown brigade, the bicycle clown brigade, which does slow motion crashes to a car that is parked in the bike lane. They're just, you know, double parked.
To illustrate bike safety and...
Well, yeah, and we don't tell them. We never say, fuck you, you're in our bike lane, because that's not effective. They're just going to get... they're going to say, fuck you, you're on my street. Well, these guys are going to say, without a word, we're just like, slow motion crash. Oh, what is this strange creature in my bike lane? They're gonna realize, wait a second, I'm in the wrong here. I'm in the bike lane, and they can't get through. Why am I being an asshole?
So now I'm here with Ben Cerf at the Museum of Reclaimed Urban Space on Avenue B below East 10th Street. And right now the museum is filled with bicycle pirate ships. And these are the ships that Ben mentioned before, where they take them out on the bike lane trying to reclaim the freedom, the free passage for bicyclists that belongs there, that's often blocked up by double parkers and people loading and unloading, preventing safe passage for all these bicyclists. So you've been a part of this this museum for a while, right?
Yes, well, we started it here a few years ago inside of a C-Squat. We've taken their storefront and cleaned it up really nice. We've got the old wall, the original wall, with all the graffiti.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm looking at a wall covered in very aged graffiti.
Yeah, no squat and crack kills. And
so for the listeners, what is the history behind this space?
Well, this space, C-Squat, is one of the few remaining squats. Eventually, the city gave it to them for a dollar, sold it to them for a dollar. And
a squatter space.
A squatter space, yeah. And we work with them to keep this thing, this community center open here, where we have, it's a gallery. We've got pictures of, since, 1989, we've got the Tompkins Square riot, pictures of that, of the tank.
Wow.
This is the tank that the police brought in when, I mean, they were militarized then as well. Like, yeah. That's a full-on tank.
That's a tank.
Without a turret, but it has muscle.
Yeah.
And it's intimidating. We have other pictures of bicycle rays, celebration of non-polluting transportation. We have the Occupy Wall Street there when they stormed the Brooklyn Bridge. All the arrests there, 800 arrests.
Quite a turnout.
Yeah.
A lot of artwork.
Yeah. Here are the pictures of the community gardens. Here's a big wall of this. There's cleanups happening.
Yeah.
ABC No Rio Garden, Esperanza, which was had an enormous frog. It's called the Garden of Hope. We have people marching.
So you've been involved in preserving open spaces, free spaces.
Yes, for a long time. Here is
Here's the proof. Here's a picture of me at a Preserve the Community Gardens event that we did. This is all with Time's Up, which is a group I've been with for 10 years or so.
Wow. Yeah, it is quite a lovely museum. You should come visit it on Avenue B, below East 10th, and send a donation.
Yes, thank you. We call it Morse, also.
Morse.
Hi, everybody. Hey, if you're interested in supporting this podcast for free, then please leave a positive rating and review on iTunes. And if you're not interested in supporting the show for free, then why not make a generous donation to my GoFundMe.com campaign? All of the necessary links are provided in the description of this episode. And if you act now, I'll send you some free Neo Bohemia stickers. Thanks, and now back to our program. And welcome back to Neo Bohemia. We're talking to Benjamin Cerf about Je ne sais quoi.
Yes.
And Benjamin was mentioning earlier that he doesn't think that he would be the one to talk about Je ne sais quoi.
Oh, well, I'm surprised that you put me in this category, because I'm surprised and just blown away by certain people. I'm surprised that, I'm always surprised to hear that people like the crazy shit that I am able to do, blessed to do. I don't consider myself a true, a luminous figure like I see.
So the difficulty in expressing what Ben is expressing is, in a way, je ne sais quoi, isn't it?
It could be.
It's not just auras and really impressive personalities.
Well, I know that there's a resonance in my voice. There's a look.
You do have a look physically, and also in your eye. Too, you get this glint when you're performing.
There's a kind of madness in the eye that I've seen. I mean, that I understand. I see the reaction, too, because I clearly can't see myself. It's something very intense that I have to tone down sometimes, mm-hmm. I feel. Like especially talking to customs agents who I just passed, coming back on Thursday from France. Government officials, police are a problem sometimes. They don't always hear my humor. I was arrested at the Mermaid Parade. That was a trip as well. And then also the jail time of 4 hours that I...
4 hours spent in jail after the Mermaid Parade.
Yeah. During the Mermaid Parade. During the best part of the Mermaid Parade, too. Uh-huh. It was stolen from me. Yeah.
It seems like every day out of the life of Benjamin Cerf is some sort of surrealist adventure.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's good. No, there is definitely a power once you start studying like physical theater, your hand starts speaking for you. You're just ordering a coffee and you're speaking volumes by the way you pull out your dollar bills, I guess. No matter how hangover you, probably because of the more hangover you are, the less in control of this you are, I guess. I've had wonderful coffee people talk about me later, how strange I was. Anyway.
Is part of it attributed to knowing and learning several languages?
I suppose, yes.
Because translation affects...
Yeah, you do have to do a lot of reading when you're learning different languages. I've read, The Little Prince in German, French, and English.
And what are the differences in translation that affect you?
Well, I don't know. It's something in the language. Something, so in the French... In the French, I focus on the rose and the love affair with his rose. And in German, it was it's the fox, which is about meeting a new person. And that has to do also with my time I spent in Germany, in Austria, really. That I came with an exuberance of the 21-year-old American French person going to Vienna. I was bouncing like Tigger, I guess, from the... I was very excited to meet people and make great friends and have intense conversations immediately. And they were little maybe set it back, you know. They push me back. They're like, you're just crazy. And plus, I have this face that, I got to talk again about this face that I've been, you know, blessed or cursed with, that it's very clown-like. And that's another reason for the mustache, by the way. It does hide a lot. This mustache that I wear now, it gives a person a kind of a distilled interpretation of me when they see me walking down the street and they want to talk to me. And I get approached a lot by all sorts of clowns and funny people, which is great. But at least I can control somewhat. They know who they're going to see. I mean, they have this vision of this mustache curled. That they think they know who I am. So and I can work with that. It's when it's uncontrolled conversation that look, I'm smart enough that I understand that I need to control the situation at all times.
Yeah.
I don't need to get beat up in an alley. I don't need to have people hitting on me when I'm not, you know, feeling like it. I control the whole thing to a certain degree, of course. There's chaos, which I enjoy. But as long as I can have something in my pocket to work with, it's that, you know, it's like being a musician of people.
And one last thing.
Oh, yeah.
What do you focus on when you read The Little Prince in English?
Oh right. The bureaucrat.
The bureaucrat?
Yeah, the bureaucrat on his little island, his little planet.
Hmm.
I don't really appreciate it. I don't like him, but I like the story about. I like their dialogue. And that reminds me, by the way, of the last exhibit that I did, which was in Germany, the balloon chain that they spoke about. One guy, clearly on Molly and a bit drunk, comes to me, and I'm holding the chain of balloons. It's 100 balloons separated by 12 feet each, so 12.
1,200 feet. They're all tied together?
Yeah, on a fishing line, 250-pound test.
And this was for a music festival?
Yeah, an EDM fest, just as an experiment. You know, in the sky, it's just floating up in the sky, held on each end by carabiners,
okay.
And then tied to us. Okay, so he comes up to me and he asks me, what is the definitive meaning of this?
What is the function of this item?
Yeah, of us is this. And I go, I'm shocked and appalled. I say, is there any definitive meaning to any art? And he looks at me and nods thoughtfully in his MDMA haze. And I said, well, to me, it's really, I'm holding this thing. And for me, at this moment, this is my working with the wind right now. I'm sailing this long strand of balloons. And, you know, because he's probably going to go to a DJ. He's probably here for a DJ. I am not. I don't care about DJs so much. I mean, I appreciate their art. Fine. It's good. It gets us moving. Okay, disclaimer. But I'm there to do art, to hold this piece and make people happy. I say, look, this is me. And to have a little rapport with him, I say, for instance, if, you know, on stage two, if there's the most brilliant DJ right there playing now, and I want to go over there, if the Mistress Wind doesn't want me to go, she's going to let me know, and she's going to pull in the different direction, and I'm going to have to stand over here. Because I've got, you know, holding this big strand of balloons, I've got to navigate trees, power lines, speaker systems.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot tear down the speaker systems. This would be tragic. Mm-hmm. This would kill the whole party. I can't do that. And then I asked, so what is your definition of this art piece? And he goes, he said a beautiful thing. He says, this is the bridge between the two stages that are, we have two different, we have a DJ on each stage. And I've got people on the other side. I'm at stage three. And I've got another person, another artist on stage one, holding the other line,
mm-hmm.
the other end of the line. And this is our bridge from DJ to DJ, from dance party to dance mm-hmm. party. In the festival, keeping us all together. It was lovely. It was
a really sense nice. Of connection.
Yeah, his thing was community. He went right for community. I was flabbergasted, nearly floored. I could have fallen down right there.
Very lovely. Mm. Ben is also really adept at the hangout after the show, too.
Ah, you noticed this.
Yes.
Yes. Well, that's an important thing. Yeah, you
speaking of Bohemia, I think that how you get your next job is that you mingle with they all go to
yeah, that's
the
one
pub
thing.
Or the,
yeah, this is something
the cafe.
Well, I enjoy that and I feel a little bit justified by I mean, Amanda Palmer, for instance, will spend hours. She's a friend of mine. Of yours as well, yeah.
My wife's.
Yes. So she will spend hours, like she will definitely have her body signed or sign bodies and mm-hmm. talk to each and every person after the show. Now, I don't do signing things. I don't think anyone cares for my signature. but I will hang out at the bar and have a drink with anyone who's enjoyed the show and wants to chill and talk, seduce me, perhaps.
Does inspiration and artistic transcendence strike you then as well as it did on the stage?
Mm. Well, I really enjoy to hear what they have to say. I've always got my own, we're always our worst critic.
I say that because you strike me as a person who will go to the bar still in costume.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of the time.
Well, usually I tailor it so that the show has me placed at the bar upon entering. So I will walk with cocktail in hand, usually, whenever I can work it. Even at the Living Theater, I I had it arranged with a bottle of wine. Mm. What is that, method?
Do you find yourself in these other types of artistic experimental projects that give a realization for you and not just the people around you?
Oh, always. Always. I'm always learning. I pride myself on being aware of every situation that I'm in. So I'm trying to be as hyper aware, sometimes to a fault, but of the surroundings and whether what I'm saying is working or failing. And, you know, that is not to say that I sometimes drink to an excess, as I do fit that into most of my roles. I bring myself to a certain level of well, it's a delicate balance. So I'm trying really hard not to be an egomaniac. I'm trying at the same time not to be scared and hold myself back. I'm trying to be open, but not without consequence. The drug of choice is alcohol, for me. And for others, it may be.
Is that your performance enhancer?
It's not an enhancer. It's to find my level, to break my insecurity and whatever's holding me back. There's this fine line of performing for people, for yourself, to make your point across, without losing your shit, without overbearing your ego, and. I'm trying to ride that wave, man. Mm-hmm. Just ride that wave, that cusp. Find that wave. Every performance is about that. I've found my rhythm. I'm happy with it. Some people don't believe in drugs or alcohol, or I believe in it all. Whatever, you know, whatever is going to take you there, to the point where you can be receptive, and give what you have to offer, and receive. Give and receive. And it is that balance that I'm riding constantly. And I've been kicked out of bands. You know, from 17, when I first picked up the bass, until 25, perhaps. I insisted on 2 bottles of beer at rehearsal to take me into that jamming zone where we can introduce a new song just to be with my good friends. I mean, these are lovers of mine. You know, when you're in a band, you're basically your family. Lovers, sometimes both. You know, it's incestuous. But whatever it is, you have to be at the right place.
So I think I may actually have found, through the course of talking to you, what I was trying to find as far as je ne sais quoi.
Well, that makes sense because it wasn't scripted, this thing, so sprung on me a bunch of questions.
Right. The thread may be intimate interactions in a performative sphere, either activist or political. Sometimes it's to large crowds as well. But there's this spark behind you, the glint in your eye, the face, that is inescapable when you are motivated to interact with an audience.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And here's another story I'll tell you. This one I did, this was very funny. I did a dance piece, and I did a little bit of modern dance just to check it out. But I was approached by a woman to do kind of interference while the dancers in a dance piece, while they are changing or whatever, to do a monologue and also to play the accordion, the concertina. But what I read was, do you remember Johnny Got His Gun?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I did this really dark piece. Like, this is an anti-war piece. Vietnam era, a man quadriplegic. He's basically just a screaming head. He cannot articulate. He can't. It's all appears in his mind, the whole piece, right? So I performed it coming from a wheelchair as a soldier at war, recovering soldier, bandage on the head, wheelchair. But I arise throughout the piece because in his mind, he is able to rant and to communicate. Mm-hmm. In reality, he cannot. He is silent. He can't even speak. He can't move. Nothing. I performed this piece at the Judson Church, and it was hot. No, granted, it was hot. I had this line of audience, and this man on the first row. Now, if you know you're going to get drowsy, you don't sit first row.
Oh, dear.
Oh, yes. Now, there he is, drowsing off. I catch him. I see him. He's in a suit, first of all, so that's already my thing.
Strike one, Benjamin Cerf. Those corporate suits, man.
He's in a suit, and if I had a pair of scissors, I would have cut it off, the tie, but I didn't, and I was busy performing. He's drowsing off, and he falls asleep, bam, in the middle of my performance. Now, I finally, through the course of the show, I get my legs, you know, I've got my legs, I start walking, I get out of the thing. I go right towards him, and he can hear me. He hears my voice, and his bleary eyes pop open, and he sees me performing. He's missed the whole thing, mm-hmm. But the people around him have heard it. And he's missed it, and I had him in my eyes. Mm-hmm. He was mortified.
Yeah.
But I didn't hurt him. I spoke to him the deepest, darkest morsel, the best line delivered straight to his soul. And I don't know that he didn't feel it. I did. But I did. And so did the ones around him. At least 20 people around him checked that moment. And we're probably scared for him and very embarrassed. Because I've been an audience member in that similar situation. Not that I fell asleep, but hoping to God that I was not picked out to be the magician's...
volunteer.
You know, the volunteer. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But this was way worse. Because he was not prepared. He was bleary-eyed and I understand. But I took that moment and I enjoyed it. So... I had the tingling. You know the tingling you get in your belly?
Yeah.
Almost to your loins? You're like, yes, yes, I fucking got you.
Well, thank you so much, Benjamin Cerf, for coming on the podcast.
Oh, man, thank you.
Is there any way we can reach you? Do you have a website? Do you have email if we're interested in...
I have a hidden website that I keep closed, so... but no, the email, yeah, it's Ben E. Violence. Ben with an E. Violence. The I is silent. It's benevolence, it's pronounced. Unless you're my enemy, and then I unleash the I. @gmail.com.
I'll put that in the notes of this episode.
Yeah, yeah. Then I've got my Facebook, which is my using my regular name, Benjamin Cerf. I don't need an antonym for that.
Great. Well, thank you. This was Benjamin Cerf, and I'm Charlie Layton, and this was Neo Bohemia. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Charlie, you're amazing.
You're amazing, Benjamin.
Stop.
Je revois le bien fait et en délire, suffoquant sous le soleil et sous la joie. Et j'entends de la musique, les cris, les rires, éclater en bordis autour de moi. Et perdu par mes agents qui me bousculent, étourdi, désemparé, je reste là. Quand soudain je me retourne, ça recule, et la foule vient me jeter bras et bras. Emporté par la foule qui nous traîne, nous entraîne, écrasés l'un contre l'autre, nous ne formons qu'un seul corps. Et le flot sans effort nous pousse enchaîner l'un et l'autre, et nous laissons tous les ennemis livrés et heureux. Entraînés par la foule qui s'élance et qui danse une folle farandole, nos deux mains ressoudées et parfois soulevées, nos deux corps lassés s'envolent et retombent tous les ennemis livrés et heureux. La 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 la. La 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 la